This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
You're about to hear an episode of Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley. New episodes will be released weekly, wherever you get your podcasts. But if you're in the UK, you can hear the full series now on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back more than 100 years to explore the lives of women who weren't prepared to play by the rules. This time I'm not investigating the crimes of lady killers. Instead, I'm looking at lady swindlers, hustlers, hoaxers, and women on the make. There'll be fewer corpses and more capers. We'll be meeting thieves, scammers, even a fake heiress as we travel back in time and round the world, from England to Wales and Scotland and the US and Australia. And we ask, what might their lives and crimes tell us about women in the past? And how very different is it for women today? This time, it's difficult not to admire a woman who's born into extreme poverty and who, through hard work and resilience, builds up an all-female business empire, creates headlines, and has a lot of fun along the way.
She was the biggest woman you ever did see, with diamond rings on her fingers and fox furs round her neck. I thought she looked like a film star.
But unfortunately, there's a catch.
Dressed to kill, those girls would descend on a West End store like a swarm of locusts and practically clean the place out inside an hour.
Of course, crime pays. It's getting caught that's the effing problem.
Today, I'll be investigating the career of Alice Diamond. She's the queen at the UK's most famous all-female crime syndicate in the early 20th century. She leads a gang of incredibly successful professional shoplifters from southeast London, known as the 40 Thieves. They believe the normal rules of law and society simply don't apply to them. I want to know, is Alice Diamond a beacon of female liberation, or is she just a serial criminal? To help me explore Alice Diamond's extraordinary story, I'm joined by Professor Lorraine Gammon, the founder of the Design Against Crime Research Initiative at Central St Martin's, London. Lorraine, welcome to Lady Swindlers.
Thank you.
Now, I'm longing to talk to you about your design work, which involves preventing shoplifting from happening. But first of all, I'm fascinated by your personal connection that you have to Alice Diamond, and that's through her apprentice shoplifter, Shirley Pitts, right?
That's quite right. I took Shirley Pitts' life story down, and I believe Shirley to be one of the last women trained by Alice to be a professional thief. So once I was with Shirley and she packed my bag for me, and I've never seen anything like it, because it's about making big things small, rolling them really tight. And she learned that from Alice so that they could get more stuff in the bag to get it out of the shop. So there was real skill involved.
How did you and Shirley Pitts, the professional shoplifter, actually become friends?
Oh, it's easy. My dad had a nightclub called the Regency Club and was a professional thief. And so even though I was never involved in crime, I always knew her.
It's fascinating the way you're talking about professional thieves. For you, it's normal?
Well, when I grew up, I've lived on five council estates in Hackney, and it wasn't very easy for women. and there weren't many career opportunities. And a lot of women were trying to make a better life for themselves and their kids. Many of them had been dumped by the men. And so basically, shoplifting was a realistic career.
That's fascinating. So let's find out more. I went with our resident historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to Southwark in southeast London to find out about Alice Diamond's early life. We're in Mint Street Park. It's a little pocket of green. We're hemmed in by a school and a big block of flats. And we're here because this is Alice Diamond's hood. She spent most of her life just around here. Is that right, Ros?
Alice was born in 1896 in the Lambeth Workhouse Infirmary, and she was the first of eight children.
Gosh.
Her father, Thomas Diamond, had a number of different jobs, but we know at one stage he was working as a market porter in Borough Market. And over the years, aside from doing his job as a market porter, he was also a bit of a criminal, right? He served sentences for felony and larceny, assaulting police officers and brawling. You could say that he was in some ways part of a criminal underworld, but also looking at his record, this is a record of casual offending, a mark of poverty and makeshift, survival. And the Diamond family was constantly moving from one set of cheap and nasty lodgings to another, probably to avoid the rent man. Alice and the Diamond family lived in addresses that basically encircle us in buildings that are now gone. Really grim tenement blocks. So I have with me, for example, a copy of the 1911 census. Okay, there we go.
Who have we got? A lot of diamonds.
A lot of diamonds, all living together. And the third one down, as you can see, is Alice Diamond. And she's aged 14.
There she is.
And she's working as a servant.
Mm.
Okay. And that's probably all that she could really hope for. Coming from the background that she came from, the limited education that she had, that or perhaps some factory work.
It says here they've got two rooms in Queen's buildings for the eight of them.
That's right, eight people crammed into two rooms. And here is a picture of the Queen's buildings on Southwark Bridge Road. Okay, and it was actually built on the site of the old Queen's Bench prison.
It's pretty grim. I have to say it looks rather like a prison, even though it isn't. And how did Alice get sucked into a life of crime?
Now, that's an interesting story. So Alice's first offence was in 1912, when she was only aged 16. And then she was cautioned for stealing chocolate from a shop in the Strand. Her first serious offence occurred when she was 17, and she was caught stealing blouses from a department store. And she went to jail for that one for 6 weeks. And then in 1915, she was imprisoned for 12 months for stealing again. And this is when she was described by a detective as the Queen of the 40 Thieves. And I brought with me a clipping from the Illustrated Police News. So you can see here.
Yeah. And she's quite young, isn't she, to be the Queen of the 40 Thieves, the leader of a criminal gang?
Yeah, she's just 18 years old. That's right.
So she's networked into a sort of criminal underworld from birth.
Yes, I mean, she grew up in poverty and in a world of make-do, where crime is used as a way to survive, if you like. But she's also rubbing shoulders with people who are starting to make a little bit more of a career out of criminal activity. And Lucy, I have a photograph of Alice Diamond here. There we go. And as you can see, she's quite an impressive looking woman. And you can't tell by this photograph, but she's actually very tall as well, 5'9".
She looks utterly terrifying. She's got this kind of dead-eyed stare. You won't want to cross her. And also, I really like her 1920s cloche hat. I hanker after that. So Alice's father is in and out of prison for stealing, but the family lives in poverty. So he's clearly not a very successful criminal. Alice has other ideas, and a possible new business model has recently presented itself. Around the turn of the 20th century, there is a revolution in shopping, with the opening of department stores such as Whiteley's, Harrods, and Selfridges. In these palatial new shops, goods are no longer kept behind counters so that you have to ask for them. Instead, they're on show. You can see things, you can touch things, you can desire things. And shopping for pleasure becomes a respectable leisure activity for upper and middle class women. Coveting luxury goods and fashionable clothes becomes normal for all classes. But if you're poor, you can look at all of these tantalising goodies but you can't afford to buy them. But if you're clever and well organised, you can probably manage to steal them. The 40 Thieves is the most successful shoplifting gang that Britain's ever seen. It's also known as the 40 Elephants, and it has a mirror image of itself in the form of the male Elephant and Castle gang, which includes relatives, lovers, and husbands. But the 40 Thieves are proud of their financial independence from the men, and they certainly don't share their proceeds with them. Now, Lorraine Gammon, you grew up in the East End of London, in an area where there was and there still is quite a lot of poverty. Can you identify with these people wanting and lusting after these things they see displayed in West End stores?
Yes, I can. I think people try to get what they want in different ways. And if jobs are not available and the culture is absolutely ridden with people who make their living from crime, it's a straightforward process.
Drawing the lens back from just shoplifting, the male Elephant and Castle gang, they focus on armed robbery and burglary, a much more violent form of property crime. And the 40 Thieves target shops. Does that kind of gender divide hold true of stealing more generally today?
Yes, it does. Although the women who do steal are often hidden from history and or their crimes are trivialised. I felt that some of the accounts I've read about women criminals have been written by men who sort of write off their professionalism and their ability to organise, actually.
So female criminals get underestimated, just like women in every other walk of life. Let's go back to the 1920s. So to get a feel for Alice Diamond's methods, I went to the heartland of her operations, London's Oxford Street. I'm outside Selfridges, one of London's biggest and most glamorous department stores. It's a real, it's a palace of shopping, much the biggest building on Oxford Street, with its pillars and flags along the roof. It's like a temple of commerce. It opened in 1909, and over the next few years, Alice planned her raids on Selfridges with military precision. Detective John Capstick at the Metropolitan Police describes the arrival of Alice's gang like this. Dressed to kill, these girls would descend on a West End store like a swarm of locusts. They'd roll up in taxis and chauffeur-driven limousines and practically clean the place out inside an hour. In 1914, there were 15 arrests in Selfridges alone in one single day. But most of the time, Alice and the gang got away with it. Now, to get the loot out of the store, the 40 Thieves would sometimes rope in an accomplice, who they'd pass the goods to, or else they might use their special big pants. The name for these pants was Grafter's Bloomers. They had giant pockets, and you'd roll up the stolen clothes or furs and hide them in these pockets of the pants. It's amazing how much they managed to roll up and hide. Maybe 50 yards of silk or a whole fur coat inside your bloomers. And when they got safely out of the store, they would jump into their waiting getaway cars. The cars are driven either by other female gang members or by male accomplices, and the police often give chase. But the police usually get outrun, especially by Alice's own huge black Chrysler. It's a beast. Back here in South London, the stolen goods are sold on as quickly as possible through a system of fences or middlemen. That's pawn shops or dodgy tailors who would alter the clothes. Sometimes the loot gets transported about in shopping baskets. Sometimes, I love this, in babies' prams. Now, the gang don't wear any of the clothes or jewels that they've stolen themselves. And that's in case the police raid their houses. They do the stealing so that they can buy clothes and jewels from the very shops that they've been stealing from. So Alice and the gang aren't just stealing to survive. They're stealing to thrive. They want to live well. It really does sound like Alice and the 40 Thieves belong in a crime caper movie. And the movies do have a huge influence on women like Alice. She can see glamorous girls on the big screen wearing lovely 1920s sportswear and lipstick and zooming around in fast cars. Alice and her gang also dress like movie stars themselves, in furs and diamonds, and they party like movie stars in London's West End restaurants and clubs. Some of the newspapers drool over Alice as if she's a star of the screen. Here's the Sunday Illustrated of March 1923, reporting on her sentence of 12 months hard labour for shoplifting.
She has pale gold hair, a tall, commanding figure, a cool demeanour, and the innocent look, which she can bring at will into her big blue eyes, have enabled her to delude people into believing that she is a woman of unimpeachable character.
That's so ridiculously glamorous. The newspaper writer's clearly got a huge crush on this lady criminal. Now, Lorraine, the fact that Alice and her gang sometimes use disguises in the stores to blend in with the other posh shoppers, and then they're clearly very interested in dressing up themselves when they go out to have a good time. There's an element of performance, isn't there?
They have an element of the criminal masquerade where they try to pretend they're one thing in to dupe the people they're stealing from. And I think there's a lot of fun in it, but I also think that it takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of sort of psyching yourself up. But because the women had each other, they did it naturally and they'd laugh about it afterwards. Alice's bravado sort of carried them along.
I'm fascinated that Alice and her gang have a kind of company manifesto, a hoister's code, it's called, which was written down by a gang associate. It was quoted by Brian MacDonald in his book called Alice Diamond and the 40 Elephants. Here's an extract. I do love this.
Discipline is expected. No drinking before a raid and early hours to bed. Proceeds from a job are equally shared by the group members involved, no matter what their role. Members must not steal from each other. Families must be looked after when a member is in prison.
Lorraine, what do you make of that code of honour?
Its codes come from a particular time, and I don't know if they're so prevalent now. You know, the honour among thieves, they were sort of comrades. And at that time, I think there was a code because there wasn't much else outside that community.
What would you say to somebody today who was tempted to shoplift and they might be thinking, oh, it's a big corporation, I'm getting one against the system by stealing? Is shoplifting victimless?
I don't think it is, because we all end up paying in the end for the security that goes on top. I'm more concerned for young people, you know, getting caught up in the criminal justice system, because that system is hell. Prison is a training ground, isn't it, for how to be a proper criminal.
Interesting. Now, Lorraine, you lead the Design Against Crime Research Initiative. Can you tell us a bit about the technical advances that have happened against shoplifting in recent times?
There's all sorts of small design features that can make a difference. You know, trolleys have been designed so you can't just walk out with all the goods. That's why they stop moving at a certain point and become very annoying. The stores are moving more and more to using AI to understand movement and to respond to movement. And certainly on self-checkout, AI can detect whether you've scanned an item or not. Many stores are aware that professional thieves come equipped for crime. So one of the things I noticed that Shirley Pitts did was she would line a bag with silver foil. And if you put an item in it and close the bag, it would stop the tag going off.
So if you come to a store with a foil-lined bag, the store is going to think this person's going to steal security-tagged items and they're going to be very suspicious of you.
Yes, they would. And I think that would lead to an arrest, you know.
Really?
And so because you would be defined as a professional thief equipped to commit crime.
Fascinating. But do you think that with determination and talent, the shoplifter will always get through? Can you ultimately stop this?
I think it's about what you have to lose. So I think that if society gives everybody some sort of equality, you know, you're not going to take the risk to shoplift because you don't want to lose the life you have. But we have a lot of people, you know, are working and they can't manage to pay bills. And so I think that we have to look at inequality, because originally that's why the 40 thieves emerged, because there weren't jobs for women and they didn't have much to lose. So why not do this?
Now, Alice and the 40 thieves mostly got away with it, but sometimes they did get caught. I went with Ross Crane to a place that was all too well known to Alice, Marlborough Street Magistrates Court. is just off Oxford Street, so a stone's throw away from Alice's favourite department stores, where she so enjoyed filling her grafter's bloomers.
Well, here we are, Roz. We're outside a very imposing building. It was once a court, and it's now a luxury hotel that's curiously appropriate, because I think that Alice, who liked posh places, would have felt quite at home in there. Now, when Alice and her gang appear before the magistrates here, they generally plead guilty in the hope of getting a shorter sentence, Roz. Is that right?
They never make excuses for their crime. Some middle-class women would have pleaded kleptomania, for example, to get off shoplifting charges. But I just don't think it would have washed in this case. Magistrates all around London knew Alice and her gang really well, despite their use of numerous aliases as well. And between 1912, that was when she was first arrested for stealing chocolate as a 16-year-old, and 1926, she is in court every single year, apart from 1917 and 1918. So she would have been extremely familiar with that building and also the cells in it.
Wow. So going to prison is like an occupational hazard for these gangsters.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. So just as the early 20th century department store would have accepted theft and shoplifting as part of their business model, the 40 thieves would have accepted stretches in prison as part of theirs.
Is it fair to say then that in the 1920s, women like Alice could make crime pay?
Well, she's certainly making crime pay, that's for sure. So, according to some sources, Alice was making a lot of money at the peak of her shoplifting career, about £30 a week, when a skilled dressmaker at this time would perhaps bring home about 30 shillings.
Wow. What kind of prison sentences are we talking about?
Well, when they were convicted, and they weren't always, they typically received short sentences of imprisonment, anywhere from 2 to 3 months up to about a year. And they served these in the local prisons in London. This was a time of decarceration, a reducing prison population, and judges really disliked giving long terms for minor offences.
There was something wrong, though, because all of these short sentences are clearly no deterrent at all to Alice and her mates.
They did see that they created a kind of revolving door effect where people just went out and came back in and went out and came back in.
So should we imagine Alice and her mates kind of strutting up these steps into the courthouse, you know, like a catwalk? They look good. They're feeling great about things. They're not going to show any remorse, are they?
No. Well, why would they? They're making money and they're getting off fairly lightly.
Huh. Lorraine, that was then, but still today we give thousands of women short prison sentences each year for shoplifting. Do you think that that works?
No, I don't. I think it's really, really daft. And so for many women who go to prison for a short sentence, they lose their home because they don't pay the rent. They lose their kids if there's no one to look after them. And a lot of crime happens in prison and people, they're teaching each other about other crimes. It's not a good environment for a person to rehabilitate. I think tagging is a potential solution. I also think restorative justice is a much better way of addressing these issues. When the victim and the criminal meet to talk about what has happened and why they've done it.
Now the end of Alice's story. By the 1930s, Alice diversifies her activities. She moves into running a brothel. And then in the 1940s, she retires from frontline shoplifting. She dies in 1952 in Lambeth Hospital at the age of 55. Her death certificate states that she was a flower seller and a spinster. She never marries. She's buried in a common grave in Streatham Park Cemetery. Here's Roz come to join us in the studio. Hi there, Roz.
Hello, Lacey, and hello, Lorraine.
Now, Lorraine, Alice lives a whole life in Southwark. She makes a lot of money from crime, but she never moves to anywhere posher or even buys a house. And when she dies, she leaves almost nothing. Where did all that money go?
I think they enjoyed it. So I think that there was the high life. And, you know, it was that generation that they didn't sort of worry about tomorrow so much. They didn't borrow money. My mother would never ever have had a mortgage because she didn't believe in debt. And so it's a very different time and culture. I'm sure Roz can say more about that.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's really important not to impose our middle class values on these people in the past. You know, we all like to think the idea, oh, you've got some money, you save it, right? You invest it, you save up for a house, and perhaps you try to keep something to pass on to your children. But that's just not how it was in working class culture.
Mm. Ros, what do you take away from the story of Alice Diamond?
Oh, so much. I mean, to start with, I love the fact that this is a professional gang of females. I think that's fantastic, because often when we think of this period, we think of the male gangs, don't we? Like the Peaky Blinders. But most of all, the story that's typically told of this period, the late 19th and early 20th century, is one of new opportunities for women, new jobs in the clerical sector, also new forms of leisure, magazines, the cinema, and shopping in those West End department stores, and also eventually the vote as well. But these opportunities, it's really important to recognise, they were not available to everyone, or they were not shared equally in society. I'm thinking here of the clothing trade and also domestic service. You might remember, Lucy, from the 1911 census that I showed you, that Alice was listed there as a servant. Mm. And these trades at this time suffered from depressed wages and also a limited ability within them for women to progress. But these women in these trades and these jobs, they wanted better lives, right? They wanted opportunities, and they wanted, most of all, to participate in this new culture that was opening up. And so pulling this all together, shoplifting, and especially this professional shoplifting that we've been talking about, provided an option for women who were failing or struggling to benefit from the new opportunities opening up in the early 20th century, to have some of the luxury, to have a career, and to have economic independence from men. So in other words, this was an alternative route to become a modern woman.
Interesting. Lorraine, I feel a real tension between admiring Alice and also condemning her. What should I feel about it?
Well, I think she was almost like a prototype feminist, because she was independent, she organised a business. There was a playfulness and a spontaneity in some of the behaviour. So there was a joy in working together. And I took away the fact that women look out for each other. But, you know, the times were very different. You know, what you have is real poverty that I don't think we understand. She left school really young. Mm-hmm. Her parents couldn't afford to pay for school. I had access to everything. I went to grammar school. And look, I'd become a professor. That was not available to working class women. Thank God for the welfare state and free education.
I like the fact that this is such a distinctly female story. Alice Diamond's gang was exclusively female, and their crimes brought them financial independence from men. And they operated in these new female-friendly spaces that the department stores were. And for Alice, shoplifting was a way of getting a better life, even a bit of that glamour that she saw on the silver screen when her other opportunities were limited to domestic service, factory work, or marriage and endless children. It's such a shame that Alice wasn't running the shops herself. With her love of clothes and her determination and her organisation, she'd have done it really well. And in the end, it's really hard to resist Alice Diamond's cheek. According to her biographer, when a magistrate from the Marlborough Street Court retired in 1933, he received an invitation to Alice's Christmas get-together. And the invitation was to meet old friends. Well, a huge thank you to Professor Lorraine Gammon and our historical consultant, Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time, we meet the fake princess who enchanted the great and the good in Regency Bristol. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhianne Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4, and you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.
It's election time in the United States, but this is social media's world, and the election is just living in it.
accurate information about elections. Unfortunately, it is not as entertaining as false information.
Join me, Mariana Spring, as I uncover how life online is shaping American people and American politics.
None of us know what's going on, but we do all know that something isn't right.
Deepfakes, polarizing algorithms, hate, and conspiracy theories.
To me, there's no other logical explanation. That entire thing was staged.
Why Do You Hate Me, USA? From BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.